And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. Well, welcome back to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, Patty Quattro, my podcast partner in crime. You and I have been having and wanting to have a long conversation about both of the seasons for the podcast, because we've taken a huge historic journey, starting with your time in Fanny. We went back in time to your Detroit roots, and now we just got to hear from your brother, Michael Quattro, as we call him, Mickey, in the last three episodes. And you and I have a lot to discuss, a lot of things to clear up, a lot of things to unpack. But most importantly, I first and foremost want to hear what you, little sister, thought about your brother Michael on the show, and what your feelings are, and any insights, and just spill the tea.
You know, it always freaks me out when I look back at how many hats this man managed to wear in the industry, from promoting to managing to booking to being an artist himself. It just blows my mind. And I've so enjoyed what we're doing, because these little jewels that keep getting discovered, like the phony funny contracts, and you know, MC5 being empty jive, and how he made those up, and just funny stories about the business and leaders in the business that he dealt with, things I didn't know. So it's been fascinating. I've loved every minute of it.
Me too. And again, we're going to keep hearing from Michael Quattro, because his stories are hilarious. And I have to say, I am blown away and so happy that he and I have become, I want to say, great buds, because he'll call me sometimes over and over again and just tell me these stories, and I want to hit the record button. So, and I will be hitting the record button. But you just said something about Mickey wearing all these hats in the biz. And the conversation that you and I want to have is about the biz. And we talked in season two. You ended that season so beautifully. I love episode 11 so much, when you recap, you summarize your incredible musical family and what it meant to grow up in Detroit in this early nascent moment of Detroit Rock City, and all of your siblings playing music, and your dad playing in a band. And the last line of the episode, you say, growing up in Detroit, and I almost can't say it without crying, and in my family was like sneaking up on magic. And I just know it moves me so much, because season two really opened my eyes to a different music world that I grew up in, because I grew up in Los Angeles in the music biz, and you grew up in Detroit in the music biz. So for you, that was magic. And I was thinking about it, kind of envious that you had that experience, because for me, growing up in LA in this musical world was like growing up in Malice. It was very different. And it's funny that you and I come together when you come out to LA in late 1973 from Detroit in this magical moment to join a band called Fanny, and you're living at my dad's house, and I'm a six-year-old, and we're hanging out together, and you come out and it's not so magical anymore. And that's the conversation that you and I want to discuss and pull out a little bit, because I think our perspectives are so unique, because we both grew up as kids in the biz. We both grew up to pursue music in the biz, but the music biz in Detroit was very different than the music biz in LA. And I think your insights about both are incredibly important. So jumping off with this idea with magic and Malice and all of that, I wanted to start with season two a little bit, talking about my reflection on you, which is, growing up in LA for me, it was all about hunger. It was all about getting to the top, who you knew, Malice, Malicious Intent. You know, everybody was clawing their way to have this, their moment of magic, but it wasn't so magical getting there. And what I loved so much about season two with you and your family was your epiphany after you're already taking music lessons, you know, with your family, but your epiphany of going to the Beatles at 16 and not crying like your girlfriends were crying, but looking at the Beatles and saying, that's what I want to do. I want to start an all-female band and I want to play rock and roll. And within months, thank you, Dave Leone, you're playing at the Hideout with this groundbreaking all-female band called the Pleasure Seekers, and you're having fun and you have all these great stories and you're going on the road and you have these hilarious, although scary, mobster stories. And you're creating this moment of rock and roll with all your homeboys and all of that. And then you get the call, and we're going to talk about this a lot in season three and season four. You get the call from Fanny's manager, Roy Silver, my dad, and Gene Millington, the bassist, saying, come on out. And we talked a little bit about this in season one as well, but you were at this point playing with your brother, Michael Quattro. You were playing in this trio. And we touched upon this in season one a little bit of what it was like to leave your phenomenal brother. I mean, the talents, as you said, he's just extraordinary, to join this all-female band. So I want your thoughts, now that we've talked about this and talking about leaving Detroit and coming to LA, and just take over here and shed some light on what I've just talked about.
Well, you know, it was really, when you proposed this wrap-up idea, it just really resonated with me, because It was so essential. There was so much interest and thirst to know more from the audience of our podcast fans on the first two. And I love filling in the gaps and, you know, just going a little deeper. It's so important about the magic that I felt in Detroit and what happened when I came to LA. It was like ripping off a Band-Aid and letting some air in. This is so important to tell the factual history. And you, Dr. Kristen, I'm so in awe of the way you have a way of holding feet to the fire. That's your historical bent. And you're so good at, you know, let's get the facts, you know, keep it no revisionist, just what happened, how you felt. Let's get it right. So I appreciate how you've handled these podcasts so far. So I always want to continue in that vein, you know, and I'll tell you, there's a quote by Hunter S. Thompson that blew my mind when I read it. And I can't even tell you when I read it, but to me, it encapsulated what happened when I got to LA. And I'll read it. He was like an American moralist, had a conflicted life, and he lived the underbelly of music and showbiz. And he wrote about it in such an amazing way. Here's what he said. I'll have to read it. The music business is a cruel and shallow money trench, a long plastic hallway where thieves and pimps run free and good men die like dogs. And there's also a negative side. That was the part of the quote I loved the most, the ending. There's also a negative side, because he saw all of it, the, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly. And he wrote about it.
Well, you know, Patty, you just said something that I think is so important. First of all, I love that quote because it is just spot on. But it is this veneer of magic, the music biz. Especially in LA. And again, I keep making this geographical distinction with you. And maybe you were young and naive in Detroit. I don't mean to gloss it all over. I mean, of course, there's other people's experiences. But I do think there is something about the underbelly of the music biz that often gets either overlooked or overshadowed by the magic. So and Hunter S. Thompson embodied both the magic and the malice, and he was able to speak to it, as so many people in the music biz either can't or don't want to. But he really says it. And I want to pay you a compliment, which is why I love doing these episodes with you and these podcasts with you, is you see things as a historian. You have that arc. You're not so self-centered as an artist that you can't see the larger picture and understand your place in it. But the music world does not revolve around you or even your family, but you understand the importance of your family in this larger music world. And that's what I think is so absolutely key. So I want you to keep going. You and I briefly talked about Detroit and LA and the differences, and I want to hear more analogies from you.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm sort of an odd duck. I was schooled in, you know, Detroit, and there was magic there. My dad, you know, I was in that bubble of the Quattro musical family and what was happening in Detroit with this magical music coming. And Dad, he didn't suffer fools. He taught us to work hard, develop our talents, our gifts, our passion. It was all about the music. That was it. Susie and I were self-taught on guitar. And we were the earliest female recorded band, you know, years before Fanny. And we grew up with the homeboys honing our craft. I mean, what an education. You couldn't take from a teacher that would teach you better than jamming with these amazing homeboys. And for me, Jeff Beck and Leslie West, I mean, my influencers, you know, it's unbelievable. So we honed our craft in Detroit, and it was the... There was no judgment there. That's what floored me. I had all these girl bands, two of them, Pleasure Seekers and Cradle, and we had gay girls, bi girls, heterosexual, you know, free love was happening in the, you know, that era. Everything was going on, politics. There was no judgment. Everybody got along because it was about the culture, the music that was coming in a way of avoiding the factories. That was the magic of Detroit. So there was this musical tolerance in its DNA, and it was a huge gift to us young kids learning music, because we supported each other and magic was happening. I mean, what could be better, you know, to learn music in that kind of context? And then I hit LA. Are you ready? Are you ready?
Buckle up.
Yeah, buckle up. The year of magic, and all of a sudden, this new element. You got to realize it was rough and emotional leaving my life, leaving my family. Susie had gone to England, starting a new journey for myself, away from my sister, being dropped into this LA scene and having to like start over by myself. It's like Bowie's song, Changes, you know? It's just, it was so different. And I was not completely stuck on gender at that point, at that transition point. I had been playing with Mike in a band. I mean, a top keyboardist. And it was amazing. So, yes, I had my original dream, the epiphany and breaking a female band, but I wasn't so unopen that, you know, I went and played with Mickey, and it was like such a rounding out for me. I loved it, you know? And Mickey, God bless him, he supported my decision. He was sad, heartbroken that I was leaving, but he understood it. That was the magic of the family in Detroit. He understood what I wanted to do, and he didn't fault me for it, and he wished me well. And yeah, he was mad and upset, you know, oh, you're leaving, you know, but we got through it. We were brother and sister. So, you know.
I want to just echo that, because this sounds so obvious to probably everyone, but your brother loves you so much. Yes. With that said, he also thinks, and I'm quoting him, that you're one of the top guitarists to have ever started off in rock and roll.
Oh, geez.
He really, really, really feels that way. But what I, again, the difference between, let's say, the magic of your family and the magic of Detroit sneaking up on this magic versus the veneer of magic in LA, and, or more so the malice of LA, your brother could have had a vendetta for leaving and pursuing your own dreams.
Yeah.
Yet he didn't. He supported you and said, you go and do it. And I think that is also another thing. So there's so many vendettas in LA in the music biz when things don't go your way. And I just wanted to point that out, how much your brother loves you. So LA and loves you. And because, you know, let me just tease that out a little bit more, because I asked him, but it bears repeating for those who may not have heard our interview with him, that your brother, and I say this with absolute love and admiration, because my father was the same way, has an ego as big as they come.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think he would deny that either. And so as I said to him, your brother loves you and thinks you're talented, but he's not, his ego trumps his love for you.
Yeah.
So the fact that he put you on all these concerts and festivals and still supports you to this day and supported you when you left working with him to come to Fanny, I mean, that's all legit. So in season one, do you want to say something, please?
About Michael, you know, I mean, that's the magic of Michael. He has this big ego. He can be abrasive, the whole thing, but he is such a loving person. It's unbelievable how much love he has for his family. And he showed me that's in there too. And it's such a dichotomy sometimes when he's going on and, you know, his, like your dad, I mean, it's so funny, but yeah, he has the best heart I've ever seen for somebody that still has that kind of an ego and confidence, you know?
My father, I want to say, was the same way as your brother, that there mm-hmm. was, so he was hilarious. He could be self-deprecating, and yet he has, yes. his ego could be so obnoxious. Sorry, Dad, but it's true.
It's true.
He also embodied magic and malice. So. Yeah. So yeah. Speaking of, you get the call from Roy Silver, you're the manager of Fanny, and there's some folklore that you and I touched upon in season one, which was your time in the band Fanny in the Casablanca years. And we're not sure, some of it is still folklore because we've been trying to find this out, but we're trying to figure out, so June Millington leaves the band and then shortly thereafter, Alice DeBure leaves. We know they left in late 1973. One of the people I spoke with, and we mentioned him in season one, but I've since then spoken with him, is Gary Stromberg, who is thanked on the liner notes of Rock and Roll Survivors, because not only was he one of my dad's best friends, but he was also your PR person while Fanny was at Casablanca. So he has a memory that's wonderful to fill in some gaps. So one of the things that, well, he knows for sure that June left and then we know Alice left, but there was not a deal to go to Casablanca. Reprise was not going to renew the contract, but the band didn't necessarily want to dissolve. But then June leaves, then Alice stays briefly, and we're going to touch upon all of that. But what I'm trying, and Gary Stromberg does not remember this, how did you come to join Fanny? Do you remember how you were selected? You say that my dad and Gene called you, but do you know how that connection even came about? And the reason why I'm asking, and I never want to put words into my dad's mouth, is I know the way my dad thought also as a PR person. And the idea, once June Millington left, of getting you, Patty Quatro, from Pleasure Seekers and Cradle, you were a rock and roll guitarist at its best. And not only that, you're Suzy Quatro's sister who's hitting it big at that moment. My dad would have absolutely run with that marketing idea. So I just want to tease this out a little bit because it's often seen in the narrative that it was June who handpicked you. And I don't remember that happening. And I don't think that my dad, because it was such a macho business at the time, so much and so much controlling going on by men in the music biz, that would have been allowed to take place. So I want your thoughts on all of this, Patty.
Okay. Can I back it up a little?
Please.
Okay. Because I think it bears, at my point of landing in LA, how I felt about it. I had been with my females in Detroit, mm-hmm. and they were, you know, we all got along so wonderfully. There was no weirdness on lineups. You know, we had lineup changes, quite a few of them. And we always stayed friends. There wasn't that thing going on. There were other girl bands in Detroit. We all got along. In fact, I stole a few people from them, you know, to join our band when we had to have a lineup change. But it all was handled so beautifully. So here I am landing in L.A.,
and well, Patty, please hold that thought because I'm so curious about where you're going with this. But that's something else I learned in season two, which is you had lineup changes and yet nobody ever referred to it as Pleasure Seekers 1, Pleasure Seekers 2.0, Cradle 1,
never,
Cradle.
Never,
you said it perfectly. It's lineup changes. So I'm sorry to interrupt. I just had to make that point because that was so refreshing for me to hear that.
Oh, it was so different in LA. I mean, this Fannie 0.1, Fannie 0.2, and all this bull. I mean, we never had that. And I mean, when you think about it, bands. I mean, do you do that with Deep Purple? Do you do that with Yardbirds, with Van Halen? It's a girl caddy thing. I don't know. I don't know how to encapsulate it, but it's so unnecessary. You know, it was still Fannie, you know. But anyway, to get back to it, when I was landing in LA, I was meeting a whole new group of female musicians. You know, it was totally different. There were some that were working their asses off with a razor up their butt. You know, I ran into a lot of them living there in the quite a few years and, you know, working their craft. There were others that actually would sleep their way to get into a band or on a tour or with a producer that existed. Yes, there was a casting couch, of
Oh,
course. You know.
absolutely. And that
Females
was
had a hard
what you,
time.
yes, I want to underscore that because that was what you did. You didn't have a lot of choices. You could either be a secretary, you could sleep your way to the top, or both. I mean, really, the avenues in the music biz for women were
It
far
was a
and few.
boys' club. You know, it was very much, and you're in the big city. It was such a difference from the magic of Detroit. And you said a word, naive. No, we weren't naive in Detroit, and we had all that, but it was so under, like, at the bottom. It didn't enter our psyche. You know, we were in it for the magic of the music, all these nationalities and pockets of Detroit, and we're jamming together. It was just to avoid the car factories. We were in the music. That was the magic of Detroit. And so, you know, I mean, there were some of the women who were egoed out in LA. They thought, you know, they're full of themselves and bad attitude. There were others that had feelings about race and being gay and they had to hide it. I mean, all of that played in, all types of females. I met them all, you know. And here I was plopped in with the Fanny girls who I did not know. I didn't meet him or anything. I met him one time at a Midwest concert with Michael. They opened for us. And that was the first time I really, you know, got to hear them maybe a song or two because we were getting ready backstage. But, you know, that was where they saw me play with Michael. I do not remember an audition at all. So either I'm going nuts and dotty or it didn't happen. I remembered the call from Gene and Roy and they wanting to continue on. And everything you said, I did have some cred from Detroit. I was known for my God, Pleasure Seekers and Cradle were like 5 years earlier. You know, we started when we were 14 and 16. I mean, so, you know, he knew the name and he was glad to have found me and called me out to join. They didn't want to stop. Your dad was going forward. And Nikki and Jean wanted to continue playing together, which is an important point. They decided to go forward, even though June was quitting for her own personal reasons. So, you know, if you go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I want to. There's something that you said that I think it's just so enlightening for me because again, I grew up in the music biz in LA. So when you're talking about egos and people climbing their way, clawing their way around, trying to get to the top, that's all I knew. You were not necessarily in the music biz in LA because you, how you put it, in Detroit, as you say, quote, music was the culture. Your quote, and I think that that's so distinctive from LA, because or it distinguishes so much from LA because in LA, music, the biz was music, and it was very convoluted. Not everyone in Hollywood or in LA was pursuing it because you wanted to create music or you wanted to act or be an actor. Sometimes you were there for the complete facade of just being a star. There was no meat behind it. So it's another refreshing, enlightening moment for me when I got to learn about your family in season two, because you, all of you and your homeboys that you talk about, all of you were doing it because music was the culture to, and especially for the homeboys to not go into the car industry, but you were honing your craft to create music. Whereas in LA, a serious musician was not necessarily everyone. I don't know. There were less of them, if you will, the ones who just had to make music versus had to be famous.
Yeah, and I'll put in another important thought, referring, you know, the difference between the magic of Detroit and the malice that I encountered. When I had the girl bands in Detroit, right, I was a rhythm guitarist to start, you know, and then we had other women come in. This was the difference between LA and Detroit. Very talented girls. I had some great guitarists. And then at some point I had to take over guitar, just like June had to. Okay. We have the same in common roots in that respect. And I didn't, there was no kind of demeaning or putting somebody down or, you know, when they would leave or we would have a lineup change. I respected those girls for their talent. And they went on to other things, you know, when we would part, but the talent, it was about the music. Again, it was about the music. And that's what I loved about it. In LA, different feel, as I came to know.